invitation on this last chapter called charity, which I suspect is what we in theological circles call agape over against eros, the love of God, the unconditioned, unresisting love of God. And the other three loves that he describes, affection and friendship and eros, these of course are God-given. He exalts them greatly. Now, he says, he comes to the point where he has to discuss if possibly these loves can become rivals of the great love, the love of God. And I'll have to read parts of this as I go on. William Morris wrote a poem, "Love is Enough," and someone reviewed it, said his brief review was, "It isn't enough," or "It isn't. Love is enough, love isn't." And such has been the burden of this book. The natural loves are not self-sufficient, as they don't manage by themselves. I suppose even where a person has no sense of God, overt sense of God, conscious self sense of God, these loves are given. Affection and friendship and eros. And so that the garden, he calls the garden, didn't create itself. It won't fence itself, it won't weed itself. And it will remain a garden that is distinct from a wilderness. Only if someone does all these things to it, its real glory is of a different kind. The very fact that it needs constant weeding and pruning bears witness to that glory. That is, it teems with life, it glows with color and smells like heaven puts forth at every hour of the summer day beauties. Which man could never have created and could not even on its own resources have imagined. You want to see the difference between its contribution and the gardener's. Put the commonest weeds it grows side by side with his hoes and rakes and shears and packet of weed killer. You have put beauty, energy, and fecundity beside dead, sterile things, just so our decency and common sense, that is this stuff we naturally have, shows gray and death-like besides the geniality of love. And when the garden is in its full glory, the gardener's contributions to that glory will still have been, in a sense, paltry compared with those of nature. And then he talks about grace coming down. And when God planted a garden, he set a man over it and set the man under himself. And when he planted the garden of our nature and caused the flowering, fruiting loves to grow there, he set our will to dress them. I think from the start we better separate out three things: will and feeling and imagination. Mm-hmm. Plays with those three, and they are different. And unless his grace comes down like the moon and the sunshine, we shall use this tool. That is the will to help them. We shall use those tools without too little purpose. But it's laborious, that is the will's laborious service, largely negative service, are indispensable. If they were needed when the garden was still paradisal, how much more now, when the soil has gone sour and the worst weed seems to thrive on it best, that is after the fall of man. If before, while we were still, let's say, in a state of bliss in the Garden of Eden, we still needed God's love to make the natural loves, pictures and with the presence of more weeds, we will need his grace even more. And while we hack and prune, we know very well that what we are hacking and pruning is big with a splendor and a vitality which our rational will could never of itself supply. And to liberate that splendor, let it become fully what it's trying to be, to have tall trees instead of scrubby tangles, sweet apples instead of crabs, is part of our purpose. Now, he talks about it's dangerous, he says, to move beyond earthly loves, beyond affection and friendship and eros, the marvelous interpersonal relations that we are given. Dangerous to press upon a man the duty of getting beyond earthly love when his real difficulty lies in getting even so far, even having friendship and affection and eros. So almost as if, well, we better settle for that. And it's no doubt easy enough to love the fellow creature less and to imagine that this is happening because we are learning to love God more, when the real reason may be quite different. We may only be mistaking the decays of nature for the increase of grace. He's dealing with the idea of a possible rivalry between these affections, friendships, and arrows over against our loving God. And he says, the answer to loving God is not to diminish these. These are gifts of God. And while they may become rivals, they are God-given and are, in a sense, rarely rivals. And at least, if they are rivals, you don't handle them by diminishing them. You handle this in some other way. But he points out that these loves, if they are to be real, for their own sakes, the loves must submit to be second things if they are to remain the things they want to be. And he talks about when God arrives, he quotes Emerson, when half gods go, the gods arrive. He changes that. He says, when God arrives, and only then half gods can remain. They can hang around now. They'll get into their proper place, left to themselves, without the presence of God. They either vanish or become demons. Only in his name can they, with beauty and security, wield their little tridents and their little arenas. The rebellious slogan, all for love, is really love's death warrant. But the question of rivalry, for these reasons, long postponed, must now be treated. And first he deals with the risk that you take in loving. He quotes Augustine, as you remember, who describes the desolation in which the death of his friend Aridius plunged him. And then he draws a moral, and he disagrees with Augustine. Moral is really that you better not give your heart to anything but God. He shouldn't have given his heart to Aridius. And all human beings pass away, so be cautious. And then he takes some real slashes at this idea of being cautious about your affections and your friendship and your falling in love or eros. Of all arguments against love, none makes so strong an appeal to my nature as careful. This might lead you to suffering. Then he points out that you've simply got to take that kind of risk. And he calls attention to Jesus, that Jesus, apparently, while he loved everybody, he had a special love for Lazarus, no doubt, and among his disciples, the disciple whom Jesus loved the most, I must think, is John, that he and that the Apostle Paul in Philippians indicates what he would suffer if Epaphroditus had died. So this idea of getting ready for God's love, or being able to love God by diminishing, or being careful, or not putting all your eggs in a basket, being cautious, this he dismisses altogether. That to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything in your heart will certainly be wrong and possibly be broken. It's almost like giving, if you're loving anybody, you really give that person a whip. And he can hurt you, and hurt you bad. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, your heart intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It'll become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers of love is hell. Then, talking about these earthly loves, we shall draw nearer to God, not by trying to avoid the suffering inherent in all these loves, but by accepting them and by offering them to him, throwing away all defensive armor. If our hearts need to be broken, and if he chooses this as the way in which they should be broken, so be it. I like that. No calculation, no careful, no caution. You love with no strings and with no reservation. Then he talks about that all natural loves can be inordinate. He uses the word inordinate, as you remember, and he says that doesn't mean insufficiently cautious, and nor does it mean too big. It's not a quantitative term at all. It's probably impossible to love any human being by simply too much. We may love him too much in proportion to our love for God, but it's the smallness of our love for God and not the greatness of our love for man that constitutes the inordinacy. He's very protective on these loves that he's already described, that they have their full place. But even this must be refined upon, otherwise we will trouble some who are very much on the right road, but alarmed because they can't feel toward God so warm a sensible emotion as they feel for the earthly beloved. Now there you have the matter of feelings coming in. Will and feelings and imagination. And I get the toward the end of the chapter, as you remember, he finally gives up and he says, I'm not sure that I have this love for God. I will it, I imagine it, but I have no way of calculating my feelings about this. And let's see, we go. It's much to be wished that you could feel as deeply or more deeply toward God than you feel toward the dearest of your friends or those who are dear to you. It's much to be wished, at least I think so. I think it's much to be wished that we all could at times feel that way. We must pray that this gift should be given us, but the question whether we are loving God or the earthly beloved more is not, so far as concerns our Christian duty, a question about the comparative intensity of the two treatments. The real question is, which, when the alternative comes, do you serve to choose? Whom do you serve to choose or put first? To which claim does your will in the last resort yield? That's a very intriguing thing about the will. I'm not able to sort this out well, but let me say, if any man comes to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and his own life also, he can't be my disciple. Those are harsh terms. And then he defines hate, how hated is used. To hate is to reject. It's not the feelings again. It's to reject, set one's face against, to make no concession to. And however sweetly and however pitiably the suggestions come, he will, for instance, and then he talks about Esau. I love Jacob and hated Esau, said God. How is the thing called God's hatred to Esau? How is that displayed in the actual story? There's no ground for assuming that Esau made a bad end and was a lost soul. The Old Testament doesn't talk in those terms. Esau's earthly life was, in every ordinary sense, a good deal more easy and more blessed than Jacob. Jacob had all the disappointments, the humiliations, the terrors, and the bereavements. But he had something which Esau had not. He's a patriarch, and he hands the Hebraic tradition, transmits the vocation and blessings, becoming our ancestor, the ancestor of our Lord. The loving of Jacob seems to mean the acceptance of Jacob for a high and a painful vocation. The hating of Esau was his rejection for that vocation. Now that takes feelings out of it. And it's a will of God. I rejected him and I accepted Jacob. He's turned down, he fails to make the grade, he's found useless for the purpose. Now it's probably not right to say that he loved, in one sense, that he loved Esau less than he loved Jacob, if we understand the love of God to be unconditioned and impartial. But this rejection, when the higher purpose had to be faced, then the choice became the choice of will. I don't say that this duty to love God, do His will, and if it requires to turn your back or reject father, mother, and so on. He said, I don't say that this duty is hard. Some may find it too easy, some hard almost beyond endurance. What is hard for all is to know when the occasion for such hating comes. Our temperaments will deceive us. The meek and the tender, husbands, submissive wives, doting parents, dutiful children will not easily believe that it has ever arrived, that a person has to be bliss because of a higher love. And he quotes Loveless. I've quoted this several times, and I don't remember that I attributed that to Loveless. Anyway, where Loveless writes in this poetry, I could not love thee, that is his wife, I could not love thee, dear, so much. Loved I not honor more. I think the situation was he was going into battle, and his wife had cautioned him to be careful, and even indicated probably that he should not go into battle because he might get killed, and that would be very bad for her. So, but he had a higher, or he had some higher orders, and I could not love thee less, loved I honor, or more, loved I honor less. And he says, Loveless can use it with confidence because his lady is also already admits, as he does, the claims to honor. In other words, their love was on the basis of a recognition of a higher demand, the love of God, that might sometime get in the way of what normally would be the demands and the benefits of the lower love or the other love. He does not need to hate her or to set his face against her, because she and he acknowledges the same law, same. Then he goes into just a discussion of friendship and marriage, the other loves, that there ought to be a recognition among friends, among husbands and wives, that there is a higher demand than the love and the attachment for one another. And he said that ought to be there before the crisis comes. It's too late when the crisis comes. Begin telling a wife or a husband or a mother or a friend that your love all along had this secret reservation under God, and that now comes a time when you have to turn your back on them for something higher. They ought to have been warned, not to be sure explicitly, but by the implication of a thousand thoughts, by the principle revealed in 100 decisions upon small matters. A disagreement on this issue should make itself felt early enough to prevent a marriage or a friendship from existing at all, because there ought to be that awareness among friends or among husbands and wives that there is a higher, that there is this higher love and a higher demand. Indeed, a real disagreement on this issue. The best love of either sort is not blind. And this brings me to the foot of the last steep ascent that this book must try to make. We must try to relate human activities called loves to that love which is God. And we must try to do it a little more precisely than we've done. Precision can, of course, be only that of a model or a symbol, certain to fail us in the long run, and even while we use it, requiring correction from other models. The humblest of us in a state of grace can have some knowledge by acquaintance, some tasting of love himself, that is, of God. But man, even at his highest sanctity and intelligence, has no direct knowledge about the ultimate being, only analogies. We can't see light, though by light we can see things. You look out there and you don't see the light. By the light you see trees and a number of things. And he likens that, it's an analogy to the love of God. You can't see it. Statements about God are extrapolations from the knowledge of other things which the divine illumination enables us to know. And I labor these points because in what follows, my efforts to be clear may suggest a confidence which I by no means feel. I should be mad if I did. Take it as one man's reverie, almost one man's myth. If anything is to be useful to you, anything is not, never give it a second. Take it. If not, dismiss it. Now, then he comes to this God is love. Herein is love, not that he loved God, but that he loved us. That he doesn't have need love or anything like that. The primal love is gift love. In God, there's no hunger that needs to be filled, only a plenteousness that desires to give. And then he comes to that. God, who needs nothing, loves into existence holy, superfluous creatures like us. in order that he may love and perfect us. He creates the universe already foreseeing, or should we say seeing. The buzzing cloud flies. He describes the crucifixion. What he puts it, what is it going to cost him? This risk that he's taking in creating wholly superfluous creatures, parasites. We always be parasites on him. And he, nonetheless, he creates us, and then he loves us, hoping by that love to make us perfect. And I, with this description of the crucifixion, and no tenses in God, the buzzing cloud of flies about the cross, the flayed black, the flayed back pressed against the uneven stake, the nails driven through the mesial nerves, the repeated incipient suffocation of the body as the body droops, the repeated torture of back and arms as it is time after time for breath's sake hitched up. If I may dare the biological image, God is a host who deliberately creates his own parasites, causes us to be that, causes us to be, that we may exploit and take advantage of him. Herein is love. This is the diagram of love himself, the inventor of all loves. There's a, Bishop Negrin has a book on Agape and Eros. He's published in three volumes to start with. And it's a great description of God's love. And it's over against other loves. And I remember trying to summarize that one time, saying, God, you can't stop God from loving you. It's just impossible. He's impartial. His love is impartial, like the rain falls on the good and evil, the sun shines on the righteous and the unrighteous. He loves his children impartially. He loves those in hell who will forever be away from him, as much as he loves those in heaven who are with him. It's that impartial. You can't stop God from loving you any more than you can stop the sun from shining. You can cut it off so that it doesn't reach you, but you can't stop the sun from shining. And it's like a great river that keeps flowing whether anybody has thought to harness its power or not. Year after year, century after century, those waters keep going, whether they're ever put to use. And unlike human love, he points out that human love is always a love that's attractive to the attractive, that loves the lovely. And maybe projects something unlovely and makes and has its possibilities are lovely. So a person can love the unlovely with a hope of making it lovely. But God's love is not really isn't calculating. It doesn't love in order to do anything to you, really. It wants to do something. It wants to remake us. But if it fails, it still keeps going. It's got nothing to do with results. It doesn't set out, really, to be a means toward an end, either. And that we have to watch. That we demean love any time we make it an end, God's love. Like Kierkegaard said, if a woman were to marry, as an example, if a woman were to marry for any other reason than love, if she were to marry on the promise that by marrying she could be the mother of the Savior of the world, and for that reason she married, she would have tarnished love. Love is an end and not a means toward any end, if it's understood as God's love, God's unconditioned, impartial love. So there's a sense in which the best way to say it, I think, is that you can't stop God from loving you. It's this give love, this giving love that keeps giving, no matter what. the need love, so far as I've been able to see, have no resemblance to the love which God is. They are either rather correlatives or opposites. Not as evil as opposite of good, of course, but as a form of blanquenage is an opposite to the form of mold. This divine love is in man enables him to love what is not naturally lovable. Lepers, criminals, enemies, morons, the sulky, the superior, and the sneering. I think at that point, too, it's necessary to sort out, again, I think it's done in the affections, and going back to what it means to love somebody and like somebody. I should attach that to some part of the book, but I think if imagine God telling me to love my enemy, and I'd say, God, I simply can't like him. And God would say, well, I didn't ask you to like him. I only asked you to love him, to meet his needs, to search out what his needs are and to fill those needs. And I'd say, well, there's nothing about him to like. God might very well say, well, there's nothing, I have a hard time with you too. I don't find much in you to like. But that's got nothing to do with it. I love you, I give my life for you. And so, like Luther says, he takes the love that we want attached to him, and he transfers it to our brother. He says, love them as I have loved you. And if you love me, love them. And whatsoever you do for them, you do for me. This kind of transfer. And I think it's extremely important. Now, that's kind of the ethics of love. That's just one aspect of it. But in trying to love God, or direct my love to him, there's a sense in which he deflects that. And fastens it to the neighbor, as the apostle, or as Luther said. And again, I suppose when he says the divine gift love in the man enables him to love what is not naturally lovable, lepers, criminals, enemies, morons, and so on. Finally, by a high paradox, God enables man to have a gift love toward himself, to give to God. I think God intends me to feel affection or feel something for the person I love, but let's say I feel only repugnance and nothing else. This fellow. But I think the point of it is I can still be God's agent to give this divine gift love to him by caring for him. Then I think that the Holy Spirit will enable a person to like those he has begun to love, or has tried to love, has tried to give. Feelings are a very tricky thing, and I can feel good, let's say, about doing for this repugnant guy who, instead of ever thanking me, misunderstanding my motives maybe, will only hate me the more for trying. I think I can feel good about doing that because the love of God constrains me, as the Apostle Paul says. It's God's gift love, and I feel good about that feeling now, on the terms of feeling. Let's see if I can think of an example of that. I've used an example over against Nora. See if that fits. Supposing I have been away and I get a feeling that I ought to buy something real nice for Nora. And so I kind of shoot the works and overcome my budgetary cautions and buy her a string of pearls. And I'm very pleased with that. And only to discover 2 weeks after I've given it to her that she's pawned the pearls. And what's worse, she's taken the money and given it to a family that I despise. I know they needed the money. But that's kind of rough. And it might be a cause of some real difficulty between Nora and me at that point. Unless I would share in some manner, number one, her motive for doing it. But even if I couldn't share that very well, in my love of her, I could see it happen. So I could be involved in this odious family. Partially because I could appreciate her motive. And even if I didn't appreciate her motive, because of my love for her. And so the feelings, my feelings for people will, the agape, or the love of God, this unconditioned, uncalculating, impartial love of God, I get caught up with it. Now, at that moment, I may not have a great feeling for God, except through Lewis says, through my imagination of God. He's very humble about this. He really doesn't know whether he has this love for God, but whether it's imagined. But it's the nearest he can come. And there are tasks in life. I'll use another illustration here, which I'll pardon me for. When we were first married, in the first 3 years we were married, 3 or 4 years, we had 3 boys. And they might have all been in diapers at one time. We had no money to buy a washing machine, but we had a couple of big tubs down in the basement. And then we bought one of these stompers, plungers. And it was my task to plunge those diapers. I remember she said, you have to 360 times each. I had no great affection for plunging diapers, nor had I entertained that as a career. And the task itself was in effect odious. But Nora was there part of the time, so we had kind of companionship over this. And then the task took on a kind of sheen because I loved her and I loved these boys. And that which was unpleasant took on a degree of pleasantness because it was kind of swallowed up in a bigger love, not a love for diapers, but a bigger love in me. And I think that's what he's saying, that the love of God has a chance to make you like, even, that which you ought to love. People and tasks and other things that are not so pleasant. Every stranger whom we feed or clothe is Christ. That transference, too. I remember the story of Kagawa at Japanese Christian of a generation ago, who, when he finished school, rented a 6x6 room down in the most disreputable part of Kobe, the Japanese city, and then he set out to serve people. And he said one day a person came to him who had his eyes were festering. He had this very infectious disease, whether it was glaucoma. Is that an infectious disease? Well, it was some infectious eye disease. It was quite common. And he said he wanted to come in for shelter for the night. And I was about to turn him away, and suddenly he seemed to change, and I seemed to see the figure of Christ with his eyes. And I took him in. And as a result, he got the eye disease too, which he never quite got rid of during his lifetime. But this kind of aura that makes affection and friendship and eros and all the interpersonal relations a kind of reflection of this radical, lavish, unconditioned divine love is possible of experience. I like what he then he says, this love of God we need whether we were sinners or not, in Adam and Eve before the fall. They were the objects of it in possessors. And after the fall, we need it more and more. But he points out that this love, while it was Adam and Eve before the fall, where they weren't loved in spite of the fall, they were loved in a sense for themselves. Although even then, maybe not because they were attractive, but simply because God loves. And now this business of being loved in spite of our sins, he says that's kind of rough. We would rather be loved because we're lovable. And we try in a very subtle way to present ourselves as lovable to God. I thought this was beautiful. Where he quotes John Bunyan describing his views of conversion. I thought there was no man in England that pleased God better than I. Well, that's step number one. Beaten out of this, we next offer our own humility for God's admiration. You know, I really am humble, God. I don't deserve anything. And surely he liked that. Or if not that, our clear-sighted and humble recognition that we still lack humility. God, you know that I am the humblest of the humble. I know how humble I am. And then he says, thus depth beneath depth, and subtlety within subtlety, there remains some lingering idea of our own, our very own attractiveness, and we've got to be attracted to God. It's easy to acknowledge, but almost impossible to realize for long, that we are mirrors with whose brightness, if we are bright at all, is wholly derived from the sun that shines upon us. Surely we must have a little, however little, native humanosity Surely we can't be quite creatures. Well, there is a tangle that's here. It's never fully acknowledged. It's our meekness. Grace substitutes a full childlike and delighted acceptance of our meekness. The joy of total dependence. We become jolly beggars. But for all time, this illusion to which nature claims as our last treasure is pretense that we have anything of our own or could, for 1 hour retained by our own strength and goodness, that God may pour into us. That would keep us from being happy, like bathers who want to keep their feet, or at least one toe, on the bottom, and not get into the glorious tumble of the surf. And finally, Anubis has got rid of his shadow. This is finally it. But to be loved by others, here's a term that I haven't thought of. For you to like me because you have God's love and you like me, not because of these secondary loves, friendliness, or affection, or eros, but you have been caught by God's love, so you're able to love me in spite of my unattractiveness. I don't like that. So he comes to terms with that, too. And how difficult it is to receive and go on receiving from others a love that does not depend on our own attraction. And he has this example of a person who's married and comes down, the husband gets an incurable disease, and where he's just in awful shape. And he won't kill you for many years. You're useless, impotent, hideous, disgusting, depending on your wife's earnings, impoverishing, where you hope to enrich, impaired even in intellect, and shaken by gusts of uncontrolled temper, full of unavoidable demands. Suppose your wife's care and pity of you to be inexhaustible. The man who can take this sweetly, who can receive all and give nothing without resentment, who can abstain even from those tiresome self-deprecations, which are really only a demand for petting and reassurance, is doing something which need love in its merely natural condition cannot attain. No doubt such a wife also will be doing something beyond the reach of the natural gift love. That's quite another point. In such a case, to receive is harder, perhaps more blessed than to give. I think of that in connection with the forgiveness, which he comes to in a little while. Is it easier to forgive someone or to be forgiven by someone? In fact, you'd have to say it's much harder to be forgiven by someone than to forgive. Because to be forgiven by someone is to recognize the need of forgiveness. You're not. To forgive can almost be almost be a kind of condescension. You, the perfect one, forgiving somebody. And in that connection, I've even wondered whether we ever have a right to forgive, except as the forgiveness of Christ is transmitted through us. I don't know how many of you remember in Tolstoy's War and Peace, where Pierre, who married in part for convenience, as you remember, though he was a noble fellow, and then a military captain seduced his wife, or had an affair with her, and then Pierre and the captain happened to meet on the field of battle, And they're together in the tent, and the captain asks Pierre's forgiveness. And Pierre says, "I can't forgive you. I have no right to forgive you, because I should not have married her. I knew she didn't love me as she should love me. So I offended her. It is not right for me," I'm not quoting directly, "it's not right for me, who needs forgiveness, to be the forgiver." And I've thought of supposing a husband and wife have been estranged. Supposing he's had an affair with somebody and she has sued for divorce, and you come, or I come as her pastor to see her. And I'll say, John is terribly sorry. And he wants to come back. And won't you forgive him? And let's say that after a while, he says, "Yes, okay, I'll forgive the old skunk." Now, what she's reflecting is that she is not forgiving out of being forgiven. Now, she doesn't have to be forgiven for this episode because he's the offender. But if she's entrenched in the love of God, if she's swallowed up in this all-consuming love, and she knows that she, of herself, has needed, does need, will continue to need for the rest of her life, this forgiving love of God, and that she's gotten it, then there's a sense in which she can transmit the forgiveness that she has, the forgiveness of God. She can transmit that to John. She is kind of the agent. But she's not up here and he's down here. Somehow they're on the level, and that neither one is more deserving than the other. And if she could do that, out of this awareness of being the recipient of God's love, undeserved, then there's a sense in which the forgiveness is a kind of gay thing. George MacDonald has a marvelous statement. He said, "To love people and to forgive them is the luxury, you know, the luxury of the Christian life. The fun of the Christian life is to look in that relationship, on that kind of level." And he talks about forgiveness where you make too much of that. It's caught up in this love, this agape, that you wouldn't make so much of that. Talks about people who are always unnecessarily asking or insufferably offering forgiveness. Who would not rather live with those ordinary people who get over their tantrums and ours unemphatically, letting a meal, a night's sleep, or a joke mend it all? The real work must be, of all our works, the most secret, even as far as possible, secret from ourselves. I think this is it's a part of the sense of humor also, that is in looking at ourselves, that when I fail, I'm a kind of a clown, you know. I've behaved out of character. I'm a child of God, and I'm a part of His kingdom, and love is the atmosphere of the kingdom. And here I lost my temper and did something that that I shouldn't have done. And now, instead of making a great fuss over that, particularly if I've lost my temper over somebody who also is caught up in his love of God business, we should kind of take that in stride. And very often that's what does happen. Two people who love each other and let us say understand God's love, and you lose your temper. Well, instead of calling for a confessional service on page 272 or something like that, and having forgiveness with the absolution of an absolution with the laying on of hands or something like that, it could be that half an hour after the thing is over and after the blow, he may come along, and if he's been the one to blow, he may come along and simply offer her a, would you like a cup of coffee? And that's about the same as going to confession and getting the absolution. In the context of this love of God, I think that's what he's saying. Our right hand must not know what our left hand is. It's kind of business.
So it's so hard to be the elder brother in that. I mean, then you put the guy, then you're on the spot. You might need the confessional service to get it out.
What's he saying? We've not got far enough. If we play a game of cards with the children merely to amuse them or to show that they are forgiven, that's the best we can do. We're right to do it, but it'd be better if a deeper, less conscious charity threw us into a frame of mind in which a little fun with the children was the thing we should, at that moment, like best, without setting out to make it up to them. Just come back to each other without
I don't understand the releasement by being the older brother in that situation.
Releasement, that person who's, well, like you're saying, about being able to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
Being the culprit and asking forgiveness in that kind of situation, I just feel from, at least in domestic turmoils, it's really difficult to accept that situation then is finished. Somehow I'm going to grind the axe and say, well, why did you do it? Why don't you think people, that there's something.
To yourself.
No, to John. I want to see more than a cup of coffee then. It takes something in order for me not to be able to live in forgiveness at that time too. That may very well be the moment, but I have to be in some kind of graceful state.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't normal for me either.
No.
So that there's, I don't know.
But I think the point he makes, if we are caught up with the love of God, is a good one, that we shouldn't always need to have a confessional service.
No. And just what you just read struck me so much, the deeper, less conscious charity, that the less conscious that we have to be of something, the deeper it's gone.
Yeah.
Really,
when he says, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing somewhere here.
I never heard that in that context much, really.
But it's fun when you think of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it could be that. Toward the end, he talks about what heaven's going to be like. And what we can do with these loves in heaven. If my love for wife or friend, in my love for wife or friend, the only eternal element is the transforming presence of love himself. By that presence, if at all, the other elements may hope, as our physical bodies hope, be raised from the dead. For this only is holy in them, and this only is the Lord. I've been a little more anthropomorphic, I think, than that. And hope and then we shall love them more than we do now. I can buy that. And his book, The Great Divorce, is where he deals with this state of heaven. He gets heaven pretty anthropomorphic up there, I think, it seems to me, except that to love the beloved here and therefore want heaven and therefore want God is to put the cart before the horse. But he finally ends up by kind of a kind of great appreciative love, supernatural appreciative love toward himself that he wakes in us is the thing. And here, not in our natural love, nor even in ethics, is the transfer of love to somebody because of my will or God's will, lies the true center of all human and angelic life. For this, all things are possible. Now, he has a discussion in one of his books, the letters, where he talks about the order of service on Sunday morning, the effect on any order of service, and he objects to any tampering with the order. And he's the Episcopal order, and he doesn't like anybody tampering with the order, because he said the purpose of the service is to transport you into the presence of God. And any tampering with the order disturbed that plan. So this being in the presence of God and being swallowed up by his love is the and that love transmutes, glorifies all the other loves. That's the end of the summum bonum. And then he says, God knows not I, whether I have ever tasted this love. Perhaps I have only imagined the tasting. Those like myself, whose imagination far exceeds their obedience, are subject to a just penalty. We easily imagine conditions far higher than any we have really reached. If we describe what we have imagined, we may make others and make ourselves believe that we've really been there. And if I have only imagined it, it's a further delusion that even the imagining has at some moments made all other objects of desire, yes, even peace, even to have no more fears, look like broken toys and faded flowers, perhaps. Perhaps. And here's a, I think, a very touching one. Perhaps for many of us, all experience merely defines, so to speak, the shape of that gap where our love of God ought to be. It is not enough, it is something. If we can't practice the presence of God, it's something to practice the absence of God. Become increasingly aware of our own unawareness. Till we feel like men who should stand beside a great cataract and hear no noise, or like a man in a story who looks in a mirror and finds no face there, or a man in a dream who stretches out his hand to visible objects and gets no sensation of touch. To know that one is dreaming is to be no longer perfectly asleep. But for news of the fully waking world, you must go to my betters. We're reaching for something that's pretty hard to touch. We all know something about being attracted to other people.
In your talk, you briefly touched on anger and how that can sometimes flare up. And I guess the thing that bothers me in my life is that sometimes I have a tendency to be a nice guy. You know, and for some people that also is repugnant. Because they say, where is your salt or your grit? Where is the color in your personality if you are always a nice guy?
Yeah.
You know.
Or where is your...
Do you really care for me?
Yeah.
That kind
or where
of
is your sense of values? If you can't be indignant over it, tell me.
Yeah.
Well, this... Are you talking about the capacity to feel anger?
Yeah, I guess maybe to trust that if you... You let this anger go, that person will walk away,
yeah.
You know, or that the situation will be handleable, controllable.
Yeah.
I think oftentimes in my life experience, I've kind of held back on an emotion. You know, and said, well, maybe this isn't the time or the place, or maybe this person isn't ready for it. Or maybe I'm afraid of the emotion myself, because I know that there's a lot more behind it, and will I be able to control it when it comes up?
Do you think that's bad?
Well, in an attempt to try to be real to people is what I guess I'm reaching out for. Is, you know, when can a person really be real, and when can he express himself as to how he feels?
Most talks about the thing about being safe. I think it's in this chapter. Well, if you try to loving, you know, see, letting yourself in love with St. Augustine say, I don't know what that quote is about, being loving God more, so that you won't be hurt so by the passing of an earthly love. And Holmes doesn't agree with him because he says loving is always going to hurt. And I think that's what you said. You know, you think of that. But you can't, there isn't an insured love. It's more, this is, Ruskin said that too, this is the veil of weeping, the shadowing, the valley of weeping, the veil of sorrows. The earth isn't heaven. And the loves that give us a taste of heaven aren't heavenly yet. And you know, this is, although you go ahead and jump into things, it doesn't mean that they end up in good all around.
Because I think anger, like love, is a passion. You respond with feeling. And I suppose, in one sense, A person might be honored by having you be angry instead of just passing it by. He matters to me because you register. I don't think that's a good argument for that you've got to show your anger in order to show you that you care for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's always laid out on the table, but I think that's right. The times of person would much rather have you blow than slink away.
Well, this may be a poor analogy, but like slapping a puppy in the nose because he's making a nuisance of himself? Is that sort of what you're aiming at? That kind of a response? Except, I say it's a poor analogy, but...
I guess I'm thinking more in terms of... I see that anger can be a healthy thing when it is not used to be destructive.
That's what I mean.
To be uplifting, sometimes you have to break down something in order to build it up properly.
And this is being loving because you're responding out of love, like Dr. Redman was saying, out of caring.
Calculated anger has a problem in that too, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the calculation is where with a dog you would calculate that they slap his nose. But if I do that to a person, if I say, okay, this person needs me to get angry at them, it's almost, even though I can see how it might work, I can see that someone needs to be, to know how much I care by allowing myself to be angry. If I do it, then it's kind of, it's all, even though it looks like it'll work, I can't do it. At least that's the way I take it. I mean, if I calculatedly say this guy needs it, and it might be right, and it might be efficient, but I, even though that's true, I can't do it. I'm making a puppy out of a person. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. One thing that helps in that, I think, is to, and I have a problem like that too sometimes, but to look back and see that people have gotten angry with me, and it wasn't as destructive as I make it seem. I'm 28. People have been angry at me a lot. It's been good. It's not something that has destroyed me. And so I need to fear it less. Although I still, on certain occasions, I just have to break. I mean, I just have to walk away from a particular relationship because it's at the point of, you know, I can't get angry little enough. You know, in this particular instance, so I have to leave and hope that someone else comes in and fills the void. It's an odd sort of sense of humor about yourself that can help.
Because it seems to me on occasion, the Lord certainly didn't wear silk gloves.
Yeah.
He really blessed them.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also say that if you are going to respond in this way to what you see a person needs as being, you ought to be pretty sure that you know what his needs really are. And question where that knowledge comes to you from.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, may I ask a question, please? Can one forgive and still forget, or does one yet remember though they forgive?
Well, I don't think you can forget. I mean, that is, God can. That's almost consoling.
He,
what he says, he forgets. So you better try anyway. But we're finite creatures. We can, I suppose, forget. Pray that he helps us forget. But I think there are, that's the price of being mortal, being human.
Can one rise above the necessity of forgiveness?
Well, I suppose one way is to say I never cared to start with. I didn't care what he did. So I don't have to forgive him because I don't, it doesn't bother me. That's hardly rising above him. I don't suppose that's what you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the question, whether it was, the forgiver or the forgivee that's rising?
It's a double-faced question.
Yeah.
Can one forgive, phase one, can one forgive and forget?
Yeah.
And phase two is, if one cannot forget, can one rise above the necessity of forgiveness?
To be forgiven or to forgive somebody else?
You can approach it from either aspect.
Maybe if you lose consciousness.
Yeah,
like he says it in the book someplace about, you can lose the consciousness of the need for God, for instance, and think you're doing fine. But what we need to do is maybe increase the consciousness of our need for forgiveness sometimes. Like the order of service. Or the idea of something that struck me is that you're living in the presence of God, and what that does, if you're living in the presence of God and not the presence of the Mr. Jones next door, who you can usually rationalize pretty well that you're at least 10 degrees better off than she or he is, you know, then it doesn't, I don't think that question probably would And you have too much time for that. The need, I think, is there if I remember to put myself in that relationship, but as of mostly I don't. Mostly I live according to my relatives.
There's something in that too, that any person that I feel like, or if somebody wants me to forgive them right away, I think of a number of things that they need to forgive in me. I mean, it happens that way. I mean, or if I think I should...
What does Adam mean?
But it seems like when you think of forgiveness, it almost has to go both ways. The attorney talks about meaning and conviction of sin, and what you said, Al, about being reminded of our own, you know, and if you know how desperately you need it, you know, someone asks forgiveness of you, you recall how desperately you need it, and then that forgiveness can be some kind of a joy or a dance. But outside of that, I don't think, it's like I wouldn't want to be above or beneath that. You can't live either place. You can't breathe in marble and cold marble, and you can't breathe in outer space. There's just nothing there. That other thing about forgetting, you can't forget that finite, maybe the connection with finite, things are etched on the mind. I mean, we can't forget, but you could need to pay attention to that scribble. Like a person can, you know, slash you and do something just absolutely cruel to you. Now, you can't forget that, but you needn't attend it. But even to not attend it, you've got to pray like crazy to be shown something in the person. Besides that, or you just cannot bear have that person, because you are always seeing him through that, the lens of that slash.
I'm reminded of Paul in the Bible, who forgave practically everyone.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that
funny? But he never did forget. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he wrote years later of those whom he had forgiven. So apparently he had not forgotten.
No, I said I can't see how you can forget. But you
need. I can't
love,
either.
You know.
Well, isn't it possible when you respond in anger, getting back to Bob Partlayer, that you can communicate very thoroughly, "No, I love you, but I do not love what you are doing."
Yeah, I think so.
And in that sense, communicate what's happening. Mm-hmm. So that you communicate, just so that you communicate both. And say, therefore, I can forgive what you're doing because I love you. But it'll be difficult to forget because it has disturbed me or it has violated whatever about me. Yeah.
Very good answer.
If we were able sufficiently to live in the climate, within the love of God, and within forgiveness, which is the same thing, this love forgives, would it be possible that you might be almost unconscious, almost unaware of people who hurt you, because the moment they hurt you, there was forgiveness on your part to cover that. It was almost, forgiveness. If you use McDonald's term, the occasion for the fun, the Christian life, came now for you to forgive him. The luxury, the merriment of it was not in the sober, melodramatic episode of confession and forgiveness all the time, but it's just kind of a stream of awareness that you're confessing and you're forgiving and why create in such peaks or about this when it's a stream.
The fun, the phrase, the fun of the Christian life is a tremendous help. That's, and in a sense, that's the reality. That's the Christian reality. You wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I mean, where else would you want to be?
That means you're really
what are the alternatives?
Not this grace that you're talking about. No question about that. I don't remember well now the character, Dostoevsky's character, the idiot, in this book and with that title, but I remember someone saying that that's, in all the literature of the world, that's the most Christ-like figure that has been created, it's this idiot. And then I was thinking of that when somebody called my attention to the fact that a retarded person, I suppose there are various levels of that, but that a retarded person in some ways is with his naivete almost, and he's just naturally kind, and it doesn't, and if you get mad at him, he just kind of rides it out, and he doesn't get mad at you. I mean to say that that a retarded person is necessarily has, by being retarded, the Christian virtue. But as I recall, this idiot was like that, kind of unconscious of the fact that people were batting him around. And his level of operation remained the same, whether he was buffeted or not.
That's Alyosha does that.
In the Brothers.
Brothers Karamazov, somebody will chew on his finger and he doesn't even respond. Why did you do that? And he just walks along and he has a load of suffering that would break most people, and yet he carries it as lightly as a note to someone. He just goes right on through. That. I think the hard texts from the Bible are all probably more easily understood by the retarded than the so-called higher people with higher intelligence. Corey Tim Bloom has that little book on their experiences with the retarded and how they'll pick up on text that's, people with high IQs will fight to understand all their lives. And they'll say, oh, forgiveness, okay. I mean, the place is set. It's a good measure of theology, too. Probably a good theology if somebody with an IQ of 80 can understand what you're talking about.
Well, I like the fact that he's couched so much in the will and imagination and come down rather lightly on feelings. As if feelings, you don't have much to do with that, but you can exercise your imagination and your will. And I guess the New Testament, when I think of an all business of feelings, has God ever asked us to feel anything? He's asked us to do it. He never asked us to feel anything. And if you want to know, if any man is wills to do his will, he shall know. So even knowledge is even the path to the intellect, as far as the truths of God are concerned, is in the area of doing or willing. And I think we have a tendency to explore our feelings a good deal, and that may be tricky.
Yeah. Like the spider, the image that I like from that is that feelings are like spider webs, and if you start getting into them, you do nothing but destroy. caused turbulence to something that was beautiful as long as you kept your hands off. Mm-hmm. But our hands are too big to fix a spider web.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's one string missing, we'll just make a real mess of it if we try to repair that. If we lack one feeling that we appreciate in someone else and we're going to try to put it back, we'll destroy the whole fabric, the whole thing. And heck, you know, that's part of this brother ass thing too. You know, if your feelings are, you know, eat a pork, you know, eat too much pork, and there's all your feelings, you know, you get indigestion, and you start all of a sudden, you hate everybody. The thing about, you know, you can't exercise the imagination. And will you talk some about it? And exercise the will, you ask us to do, exercise the imagination. How does that happen? We get that prayer of Paul's in Ephesians about, you know, filled with the goodness of God has, you know, beyond all imagination. And yet is hope sort of central to the exercise of the imagination? Hope, and is there a relationship or something? Interesting. It's relatively easy for me to understand exercising will, but exercising the imagination, and I want to know. And it seems like that's right, but I don't have the words to go along with knowing that's right.
Well, I suppose that's what he did. He said when he you have to do this by pictures and analogies that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And if they arise out of your experience, how many other ones?
But you exercise it by allowing it? Allowance? Yeah. And what, how does it look? Quite as deep. How would one do that? In the images and imagination goes to close, but how does one? Imagination seems to work by indirection. I mean, you've got to get something out of the way of one of your faculties in order for it to work.
See, one can, of course, imagine things, but a critical, self-critical person will soon be increasingly aware that the imagination at work is his own. He knows he's only weaving a fantasy. And simpler souls will find the phantoms they try to feed on, void of all comfort and nourishment, only to be stimulated into some semblance of reality by pitiful efforts of self-hypnotism, and perhaps by the aid of ignoble pictures and hymns, and what is worse, witches. But while he's talking there more about images of heaven than images of God. What's he doing all through this? He has great insight into experience, but he's using his imagination in
a really fertile
way to fill it out.
Probably his chapters, it's like seeing that, you know, take the two best works of art in every art museum in the world and put them in one place, and then, you know, keep moving from one to the next. Wait a minute, take a lifetime to look at this museum. And I get this, it's almost a frustration to read from one sentence to the next, and one picture to the next.
You know, we're compelled to try to believe, but we cannot yet feel, that God is our true beloved.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read that again, please?
Yes.
191 in the white book, middle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a great thing. You've got to remember that we try to reach him, and he's always a step ahead. He's on his way to us. So that's about the only comfort to have in the struggle, is that the struggle, if it leaves you only with a gap, at least somebody is there wanting to fill the gap.
Isn't this where Luther came up with our other
wonderful answer when he interpreted the third article and says, I can't find my own reason or strength.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. A jolly beggar even in that.
Mm.
A jolly beggar even in that.
His description of that forgiveness, and then the other things that he described with those little things, all the little things that happen. And, this made me think of that Kierkegaard is a religious, is an ethical man, an aesthetic man, and a religious man. The religious man is finally the one, I think he's a tax collector, but I can't remember for sure what, anyway, he looks like a tax collector, yeah. He walks into work and has breakfast with his wife and reads the newspaper and laughs at a joke. And here these other two have been these, you know, always carrying a heavy burden of reality or something,
yeah,
in some sort or another. And that apparently the religious man, at least as Kierkegaard has seen him, is his life is full, but isn't necessarily full in terms of you spend hours discussing each thing. It seemed like Lewis had a lot of that kind of a, the lightheartedness and that thing of humor. When you mentioned humor, I was thinking too of it, talking about the idea of honor, if I love not honor more, but that's something, humor is only humor when it's shared, and you can only, I mean, you might enjoy a joke, but it's not very much fun if you're the only one who gets it. The idea that in a life together with, whether it's with a mate or other people, in some other relationships, that that's all, you know, that gives the blessing that to it. You share it, not so much that someday you're going to turn and hate your, that's why you're sharing it, but so that each day can have the bounce instead of the, well, let's get together now tonight and talk over the day. And what have we learned? And what should we learn for tomorrow, John, dear? You know, kind of tone to it. And there's, you know, this kind of thing, it almost sounds like heresy. What? You don't have to think about forgiveness? What are you talking about? Now, and even when you're saying that, I'm having those kind of things like, what? Children can take communion? What? What? You know, all the things that go against what we establish as, now you're ready, now this is so, now this, now you can forgive, now you can be forgiven. But that whole thing of, I don't know. And it's a big joke, yeah, to forgive anybody, because you can't forgive anybody. You don't do it in the first place.
Yeah.
And that parable of the guy who is, you know, forgiven the small debt or the big debt, and then he goes out and ready to throw over the guy who owes him $10.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a real natural response.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, oh man, you know, that's nothing. You don't know what I did.
There's a thing here, you know, doing, having, being. And it, that is me. I have been forgiven. They have forgiveness of Christ. And my response to that is, the first response to that is to do it. Do forgiveness of other people, and maybe that is important. But the point is to be forgiving. And if you are, you're not conscious of when you do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the consciousness of your having and how total that is, I mean, that comes down around you totally. And that's what you're, you know, then if you realize that forgiving is more of, it is a way of being.
I think the idea of a place is helpful.
Place, yeah.
You know, that you, forgiveness is a place. You are in forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in that room, how can you deny that somebody else is in the room?
In the same room, yeah.
You know, maybe something like that. Instead of something that you can sort of dole out and be given a certain amount.
That image is great.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's mine. But I think it's, you know, it's, no, I think the way the Psalms have that sort of feeling that it's given me a large
broad place.
A broad place, and mm-hmm. That's what forgiveness is.
I wonder if we come from as rare a group of people that are kind of given a great deal to solitude and meditation, that we're a little more effective in dialogue, and with each other. But I think of, and probably we're missing something. I remember visiting several times a Trappist monastery near Dubuque, Iowa. You've been there? And here's this Cistercian order of monks who are pledged to silence. They can't talk to each other. I think they're allowed one phrase. It's a Latin phrase, but I can't remember the Latin, but it means remember that thou must die. That's the only greeting you can give. Very, very cheerful greeting in the morning. And for a very strict discipline that they can't talk to each other. They do, however, pray together in the Psalms particularly. They sing through the Psalms. Beautiful music. Their chants. So many times, I don't know how often, but they're given to prayer and meditation. Now, that's an extreme thing, which I suppose means that their chief concern is to relate directly to God, and not to anybody else, but go the direct route. Well, we don't do a lot of that. I don't do a lot of that.
Is that Christian?
Yeah, that's a Christian order.
No, I was thinking in terms of community and relating to one another in community and to proclaim the gospel, you know, as being one of Christ's commands to us.
Yeah, Christ, he did tell us to pray too, so they're concentrating on that one. Mm-hmm. You know, the guide who took us around said, well, these people are dedicated to praying. They're making up for all the praying you guys don't do. But I don't know how to handle solitude well, and I'm sure most Protestants don't.
Try it.
Yeah.
Try it.
Of course, they did more than that, actually. They put up a fantastic set of buildings.
Oh.
And they were famous for their large communion wafers.
Yeah. I think the disciplines of solitude, of let's say trying to reach this love of God, we probably should do more of that.
I'm always reminded of Rabbi Heschel in prayer and service are the gifts for those who call him Lord. No, God's prayer and service are God's gifts for those who call him Lord. And that it's in that order, that the service isn't a gift to us, really, or maybe to anyone without the prayer. But the prayer is Paul Homer's article. It says meditation, prayer, and then the service in an alien world. And it's got to be in that order, but not because that's a burden, but that those are gifts. That prayer is a gift. And I myself, it's so hard. And apparently 95% of seminarians have a difficulty there too. I know and Americans.
I suppose a continuing awareness that of God's love and reaching out for it and resting back in it, maybe it doesn't require an hour a day set aside for that function. When you're advised to pray without ceasing, I suppose that's a kind of continuing.
Mm-hmm. Being the prayer.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Do you have to be concerned though about that thing of Graham, you know, mentioned the thing about feelings, and that's related to experiences, and I think of that as though some particular experience is a sign, or that now you've experienced more of the presence of God in your life or something, that seems to me almost, I don't know, I think Bonhoeffer's statement about what God has given us to do, and that if we're not thankful even in the small things, why should he give us big things? Because we don't even appreciate what the little things right around us are. We don't recognize those as his gifts or whatever. And I was thinking of that, and too, and, you know, like having, that's the only thing that kind of, I still haven't resolved, well, not the only, but particular thing that's a problem for me with the book still, is just the sense as though we will get to this ecstatic moment or not. He doesn't state it that way, but that there's something that, you know, is still to come, and if I could, I don't know, I don't understand it, and I don't.
Yeah, I don't suppose you can manipulate him, you know, mm-hmm. get him to come, or manipulate feelings, and in the small, common things, if an awareness of his presence, of his involvement in them, I would think would
is it prayer when you wake up in the morning and the first thing you discover is a cathedral organ playing some fantastic hymn? Mm-hmm. You know, you marvel at the mind that's doing this as you wake up, and there's no connection, nothing, no stimulus from the day before, but it's happening. Maybe it might be the mighty fortress, it could be any one of those majestic, and other things happen. But
you mean that you think they're happening, or?
Well, you're hearing it.
Oh, I see. You're not hearing it through the window.
No.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a sound.
Oh, yeah.
It's that kind of hearing, the soundless hearing of your mind,
mm-hmm.
just as you awaken.
Mm-hmm.
Or
a child's crying is a really wake you up.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm going to be done. Or is that God's prayer? Is that God's prayer for you for the day? Or is that your prayer for God, for, you know, offered to God?
Well, it's nothing you're doing. So it's there when you awake.
Well, good thing that there's no one way that comes to us, or that we can be grasped by him.
Yeah, this is only an occasion. It isn't a constant happening or anything like that. But, you know, once, now and again, something like that will occur.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a result of a communication line, or?
Leave it to him.
Yeah. That's a good spot.
Yeah, it'd be too bad if we understood it all. I think that the mystery and sense of wonder and awe, and he leaves us there too.
Yeah.
He doesn't get us.
There's no diminishment of awe in this book.
No.
It sets out to describe and define.
Yeah.
And so often when I set out to describe and define anything, I drain the life out of it. And here's a book that the whole purpose is to describe and define it. You know, the awe and the wonder just keep increasing as the definition continues.
Well, once you really know about something, it's not intriguing, exciting, or curious anymore.
Yeah.
And so, wow, you know, this is where we're at. Our curiosity is constantly being kindled.
Aren't we trying to bridge the finite with the infinite? And doesn't this give us the motivation to go into this oral research that we have been involved in? Isn't this really the motivation? Aren't we delving on the beach? Trying to get to the other side, but we don't want to get our feet wet.
Mm-hmm. if we get them wet, I suppose there's still the Greek other shore that's there.
It's a mile away, and then if you transport yourself this mile, it's still a mile away, and another mile, and another mile, until you really achieve it.
Yeah, I think Kieran has it, because he can use it several ways, but he has a picture swimming in 70,000 fathoms of water. He said, never, after a while you get used to it, you probably swim around with, you're pretty merry while you swim. But no matter how long, the bottom isn't going to come up, and you can lie on something solid and go through the motions. You're going to swim in 70,000 fathoms until the end. Shall we deal with a mystery? We see through a glass darkly.